Biden really ran on, like, I'm just getting the band back together. And now the band's back together, and now we're not allowed to say anything. It's like, well, what if the band still kind of sucks?
Uno, dos, tres!
Yo, what's up? Welcome to In the Thick. This is a podcast about politics, race, and culture from a POC perspective, where we celebrate democracy every day now. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
And joining us from someplace in the state of Virginia is the fabulous Zerlina Maxwell. First time ever on our show, host of Zerlina on Peacock, author of The End of White Politics, How to Heal Our Liberal Divide. Hey, Zerlina, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Yes.
And joining us from Washington, D.C. is Natalie Baptista. She's a reporter with Mother Jones. Welcome to the show, Natalie.
Hey, also good to be with you today.
Yeah.
All right.
All right. So,
you ready?
Well, last week was the Thanksgiving holiday. Mm-hmm. And, you know, everybody was very concerned because there was the CDC and other warnings not to travel. Some 6 million people did pass through airport security, and that is a lot less than a typical Thanksgiving. But this was the busiest air travel that we have seen since mid-March. And because of the incubation period, right, we probably are not going to know for several weeks now if there is going to be a third wave of COVID-19. December, I think we're all kind of preparing for really bad news for a lot of people. As of our recording, on Monday morning, 266,700 people have already died from this disease. Just before Thanksgiving, the daily deaths rose to more than 2,000 a day. And the last time that was happening was May. Mm. So, you know, we've said it again, but we really are in the same place, basically. We have not made much progress, which is really sad on that front. The good news, you know, and I'm just like, oh, this vaccine, but okay, there is a vaccine with Moderna. It could be distributed as early as December 21st if emergency approval is granted by the FDA. There's also the possibility of this Pfizer vaccine. So that could happen. So there's a lot going on. Also, I think this was a time for a lot of us to disconnect, actually, purposefully.
Yes.
So we're going to do a little temperature check, which is like, yo, how you really doing? So, Natalie, we're going to start with you. How are you doing, like, the real deal? Like, how are you feeling right now?
You know, I am feeling like I am on an emotional roller coaster, and I'm sure a lot of people can relate.
Yep.
You know, the vaccine news has been really good, but the catch is that we have to make it, you know, through the winter and through the next several months. And I'm feeling very anxious about how that's going to look, and staying on the bright side for the last like 8 months has actually been really, really hard trying to find like nuggets of good news. And it's really easy to, you know, kind of like wallow in your own despair, really.
I feel that.
Damn. All right. From despair to Zerlina. Zerlina, what's your temperature check?
Well, I sort of, it's a funny morning because I woke up literally feeling optimistic, and I got through the morning show, and I'm sort of having breakfast and getting ready for my morning meeting, and my dad is like, where's the cat? And we couldn't and this is true, I'm just telling you what really happened in my house. And we couldn't find the cat, and the door had like blown open. So we're like, maybe he went outside. He does not go outside. And so I'm freaking out because like, I'm totally zen. I'm ready to face Monday. It threw me. The only reason I tell that story is because I think that, you know, in quarantine, it's like I'm making it, right? I have my routine. I have my rhythm. Yep. And then something unpredictable will happen and throw me off. And I'm like literally hyperventilating. And like, we find him. He's like hiding under a chair, chilling out. And
of course,
it was like my blood pressure went off, and then I had to like get it back down. And I was just like, but that's how I'm feeling. It's like, I'm just trying to survive the winter.
Yeah.
And I'm controlling what I can. But like, when things pop up, when you realize you have no control, you're like, ah. So I feel like I'm always like on the edge of the cliff.
Yeah.
Feel you. Julio, what's your temperature check?
You know the series John Adams?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, the one with Paul Giamatti where he has to go back to the farm and it's winter and they just stay in the farm for like 3 months.
Yeah.
Like, that's how I feel, like John Adams.
When you go, you will take Johnny with you.
That is 3,000 miles, Abigail. In winter.
I am sensible to the dangers, John. You need not remind me.
We could be taken by the British. That is madness.
9,000 fears, notwithstanding, he shall go.
You know what I'm saying? It's going to be like,
yeah,
can't leave up to your sidewalk.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that tries to keep me going is the work. So I just want to shout out one piece that we published on Latino Rebels by Tutti Alvarez, who is a truck driver from Chicago.
All right, Tutti.
Who submitted a piece, and it's about essential workers. And we published it last Wednesday. And this sentence, you know, you hear a sentence and you're like, it's in you for like 4 or 5 days. And it's still kind of really impacted me. And he said, essential workers are not heroes who choose to sacrifice their health for their neighbors. It's more accurate to frame essential workers as the neighbors were willing to sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like,
truth.
When you have to kind of check yourself a little bit, Tutti's piece like really kind of put it in perspective for me in a way that I have to kind of constantly remind about the work still needs to get done. What about you, Maria?
I was with my husband and my two adult children and myself, just the four of us in the country looking at birds, looking for that eagle that I can hear going, the eagle. I like had to download the sound an eagle makes. So I'm feeling like personally very calm.
Mm.
But then there's all of the rumblings. So I feel everybody, which is like very calm, but shit's about to go crazy at any time. And also because I, sadly, while I'm very thankful that people came out and voted and that our democracy appears to have survived, I am not one of those people who's just like, oh my God, and we have a Democratic president, and oh my God, it's going to be a, and even with all of the fabulous things, people that we know, mm-hmm, like all this, it's great, but I'm going to poop on your party, yo. And I guess I feel a little bit like I'm not taking a breath. I'm getting ready for like, oh, if you think I was taking a breath, I'm not taking a breath.
But listen, you mentioned that a little bit. So let's talk about the future of the White House, because despite Trump's attempts to disrupt democracy over and over again, you lost.
Loser.
You lost. You're like Nate Robinson getting knocked out.
Loser.
Yeah, like you lost and you lost badly. So this weekend, Wisconsin's recount reconfirmed that Biden won again, and I think he picked up some votes. More people are announced for the Biden-Harris administration. We're already feeling this sense of, like you said, Maria, don't challenge the status quo or the return to the old normal. For example, Biden has named Antony Blinken as Secretary of State, Jake Sullivan as National Security Advisor, and Linda Thomas-Greenfield as U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. All three are alums of the Obama administration. And while Biden's picks are so far diverse, like the announcement of the first ever all-women seven communication staff.
Love it.
Karine Jean-Pierre, who was on In the Thick earlier this year and is a friend of the show and a friend of Futuro Media. Or the nomination of the first Latino, Cuban-American, head of the Department of Homeland Security, Alejandro Mayorkas. Many Latino organizations praise this, but there's very little mention of the Biden campaign pledge for a deportation moratorium in the first 100 days, which was something that came up. Okay, we say this all the time. Representational politics doesn't always lead to change and equity. Zerlina, what do you make of the Biden transition? And with the mainstream narrative still hesitating to criticize Biden or confront the past, in your opinion, what is the future of progressive politics in this new administration?
Like with any administration, the work, it's not going to stop just because you have a Democrat in the White House. But it does create, I think it's Brittany Packnett who sort of frames it this way, the appropriate set of conditions that would allow for any progressive change that we want. And of course, that hinges on the two Senate races coming up in Georgia in January that will determine the majority of the Senate. So caveat. But I think I'm somebody who believes that representation matters for the picture and also for the perspective. So it's not just that he's picked, you know, all women and qualified in a diverse group of women to be his communications staff and also the communications staff for the vice president.
Yeah.
But it's literally the best people for those jobs. They have mm-hmm. the right experience. And so it goes to show that if you make an effort and put intention behind wanting to make history in this way or wanting to make sure that you have the exact kind of perspectives in the room to put this administration on a path towards some sort of success on a policy level, mm-hmm. that, you know, these kinds of moments are important. And it's not that I'm, you know, Pollyannish about it, but I think you either have conditions you can work with or conditions that you absolutely cannot work with. And I think the last 4 years demonstrated that it does matter.
For sure.
Who is in the White House.
Oh, hell yes.
I mean, I've obviously sort of gone through in my adulthood. I remember in college, you know, when the 2000 election was sort of confusing and they sort of projected George Bush won. And then, of course, all the month long drama happened after that. But I remember mm-hmm. when they changed the, you know, the graphic on the screen from Gore to Bush.
Stand by. CNN right now is moving our earlier declaration of Florida back to the too close to call column.
Ah.
And sort of like feeling my stomach drop. And somebody in the room was like, well, it doesn't really matter that much, like who the president is. Like one president isn't going to like make or break anything. And I remember that being the dumbest thing anyone has ever said in my presence in yeah. the history of life. To this day, it's still one of the dumbest things anyone has ever said so earnestly and really believed it. And I was like, that is the dumbest thing I've ever heard. I might have said that at the time. I think it wasn't my boyfriend at the time who said that too, which is more funny.
You definitely said it. If you're like, oh, yeah, I said it.
Exactly. I think it was. And I was like, that is so dumb.
That is so dumb. I'm breaking up with you, dummy. I was just waiting for you to say that.
It was really dumb. But I think, you know, it's ironic that it was George W. Bush we were talking about at the time, because obviously no one can argue that he did not have a horrible, you know, impact, not just domestically, but globally because of the wars that he started. And so I think that we can't sit here today and say who the president is doesn't matter. So I think these historic hires are a signal to us progressives that Biden and Harris as an administration are taking the optics and the substance seriously. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that the work of activists and grassroots leaders stops. But it can't be as effective when you do not even have a workable set of conditions. And one of the conditions, I think, is having an administration that you don't have to convince racism is a problem.
Right.
You already sort of have their understanding on a value set when you walk in. And so, you know, the fun happens in the fight after that.
Mm.
And that's why I love the title of your book, Zerlina, because I'm not down with liberals. I think liberals are very problematic. I think white liberals are extraordinarily problematic. And so fool me once, fool me twice, but now you're going to try and fool me a third time. So I'm a little bit more circumspect. But what about you, Natalie? What's your take?
You know, Maria, I'm definitely in your camp here.
Ooh.
And just to say that I do think that, like, for instance, I'm really excited that the vice president is a biracial woman. That's like super cool. But like, personally, that's not enough for me. That's absolutely not enough for me.
Right.
And I am worried that we've now, you know, it's like, wow, Trump lost. We're all really excited. But now it's like beyond the pale to demand that Biden do things. And if Biden does something that we don't like, we can't say anything. Because then, like, you know, I've already been called a Trump supporter. I'm like, me? My parents are fucking Haitian immigrants. I'm not a Trump supporter. Stop. Like, don't embarrass yourself. And, you know, I worry that, you know, Biden really ran on, like, I'm just getting the band back together. And now the band's back together. And now we're not allowed to say anything. It's like, well, what if the band still kind of sucks? And, you know, to Zerlina's point, like, these are people who should listen and will listen. And so I think we can go and, like, demand a whole bunch of stuff. You know, I really just want liberals to focus on giving us stuff. I voted for Biden. I want my stuff now.
Yeah.
Please give it to me.
We are, in effect, living through a lame duck period of finally Trump's end of the presidency. And we are watching some of his totally to be expected crazy final actions. Every administration has these midnight regulations, but yo, this is some crazy stuff. So from Trump's nonstop tweets to his granting a full pardon to former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn.
Guilty.
Police. You know, the guy who pleaded guilty twice for lying to the FBI.
I mean, even Trump said he did it on Twitter.
I was like, he did it. Okay, fine. There's another thing that Trump has been doing that hasn't gotten much attention, and that's the increase in the number of federal governments allowing and supporting of the execution of incarcerated citizens.
Right. And Natalie, you reported on this recently for Mother Jones, saying how you're bothered that Trump isn't bragging about the escalation of the lame duck executions as he does with his other actions. And you write, as President Donald Trump was mounting more meritless court challenges to the election he had clearly lost, Orlando Hall was executed at the federal prison in Terre Haute, Indiana. The day after his execution, which was the first carried out by a lame duck president in more than a century, the administration announced that it would be doubling down on its killing spree. Another three inmates would be executed in the weeks leading up to President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration, bringing the total number of inmates scheduled to die during the lame duck session to six.
I mean, the Justice Department is also rushing to change the rules so that they can execute inmates. Yes, you're hearing this correct. By not only electrocution, but also firing squad. Biden has switched and is now taking a stance against the federal death penalty. But the inhumanity that is being intensified in Trump's final days is frightening. Natalie, talk to us about these lame duck executions. I mean, is there more to come? And what are your thoughts about these final actions?
I would not put it past them to try to squeeze in a few more. I mean, the thing that spurred me to write that column was I was losing my mind over how he wasn't tweeting about it. I mean, I was like, this is like, this is like Trump's bread and butter. I'm like, so you're telling me he doesn't even care. He's just sending people to court to fight these dumb challenges, and he's golfing. He doesn't even care. And if the federal government has bent its will to do everything in service of Trump, why are they doing this if he doesn't care?
Right.
I feel like someone should like go knock on Barr's door and be like, yo, he doesn't even care. So like, we're good here. Like no one's even noticing. So like, you ain't got to do all this. Like, I'm losing my mind over it. It just seems so cruel and senseless. I'm like, what is the point? Nobody's asking for this.
Zerlina, what are you worried about in terms of some of these midnight final actions?
Well, the death penalty is an abomination. I was pretty young when I was like, we shouldn't be doing that. That's stupid. You know, like, we're deciding who should. That doesn't seem like a good idea. So I'm staunchly opposed to the death penalty. And I'm very concerned about these late changes, not just to this, but also I was reading about some immigration changes.
Yeah.
And I just feel like they're basically, it's sort of, one of my friends has an expression like burning down Rome. And sort of like when you're on your way out of a place, like, you know, say you're quitting a job or something and you sort of like burn it down on the way out. But like, I always sort of think about the people that are in the rubble and what impact those kinds of late changes. I mean, Adam Serwer was the person who coined the cruelty is the point. It doesn't seem on a policy level, to your point, that there's any reason to do this now other than just to use every single lever of power that you have at your disposal and abuse it. I mean, that's one of the hallmarks of this administration. And I feel concerned that there's not more oversight of that in this moment. I feel like there's a lot they're doing that we're missing because we're talking about the transition and we should be talking about those things. But I feel like, you know, Donald Trump is golfing and maybe optically, like on the surface, it doesn't look like he cares, but he's talking to somebody on the phone when he gets back from golf and he's getting updates and he's like mucking it up with his, you know, cronies and sending Jared to the Middle East for God knows why. And there's a lot of work to be done in terms of holding these folks accountable even after they're out of office. And I don't know if the Biden-Harris team will have the stomach for that or the bandwidth considering what's happening with COVID. But I am hopeful that whoever is, you know, selected as attorney general, whoever is put in positions where they can look into some of these things, maybe that's congressional investigations in the future, that they should.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure there are some crimes, perhaps.
I know somebody who's looking into them. Letitia James.
Yes.
She ain't sleeping.
So one of the things that we've been talking is that the Trump administration is on track to finalize some 36 major rules in its final weeks. So, Zerlina, you mentioned that you were reading a couple of things about immigration, and I wanted to actually specifically quote ProPublica because it was about some of these rules and, you know, actions that are being taken and how hard it's going to be to roll back under a Biden-Harris administration. So let me just read this quote from ProPublica. The White House is close to completing several rules that would extend Trump's record of restricting immigration and make the changes harder for the Biden administration to reverse. The pending rules would make it more difficult to claim asylum by excluding people with criminal convictions, even those that have been expunged, drastically shortening the application time and giving immigration judges more latitude to pick and choose what evidence to consider. So I guess the question, Natalie, that I have is like, is it going to be possible? Like, I mean, Zerlina just mentioned, you know, there's a global pandemic, and I think that's going to be the focus on, you know, January, you know, 1202 Right. inauguration day. It's like, you know, something's going to be dramatic about COVID, you know, expected. How do you push back against these major rules that are happening? Mm. Will it even be possible for Biden to undo some of this havoc?
I mean, it's terrifying to think of the task ahead of them. I mean, COVID is everybody's focus and it's monumental and it's really important. And you're completely right. You know, I worry about all of the last minute things that the Trump team is doing, basically just breaking everything on their way out. And now like the Biden-Harris team has to fix it. And like, that's a lot of work.
Right.
And, you know, I don't envy having to prioritize all of the things that are now broken that need to be fixed. And all of them is going to feel like the number one issue to lots of different people, right? It's going to be a huge balance. And I just think, you know, for the entire administration, for Biden's entire term, we're really just going to be feeling those after effects of all of the things that Trump broke.
Zerlina, what's your take on fighting back against the permanency of some of the things that Trump has done?
I look at it not with overly optimistic eyes, but right. I, for some reason, I feel like, especially because I'm in quarantine with my family and I'm surrounded by images of my grandparents and, you know, I have family members who marched in Selma and there's pictures of Jesse Jackson, black and white. So it just, it feels to me a lot of the time, as difficult as this moment is, there have been worse moments. There have been better moments, but there have been worse moments. And somehow everybody who is in our lineage survived that. I think about that a lot. And I think it's, I guess I'm just quoting Brittany Packness today, but she had a post like, you know, every black person you meet is a miracle. I think about the fact that my ancestors survived so that I could be here, so I could use my voice to make good happen in the world somehow. And like, even if it's just a small little sliver, you know, that has a compound effect. So I feel both like stressed out and anxious, just like everyone else, about the enormity of the challenges. But I also know that it could have been so much worse, man. A couple of days before the election, I was like, I can't even set a goal for the next month because I don't even know if we're going to have to pack up the dog and the cat and like hightail out of here.
No, that's true.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
It felt like end of world. Like I can't make a plan for January because it might be the end of the world, the end of the democracy.
Yeah.
Particularly because I live with a biologist. So COVID, I intimately understand it in a way I really don't want to, but I do.
You have way too much information. You're like,
way too much information.
Giving me these details.
I mean, I'm serious. My dad told me to wear a mask in February.
Oh, yeah.
Listen, I think that, you know, I'm sitting here with the full weight of history and sort of thinking about what I can do, even just in my day to day, to help move the needle just a little bit in my small little domain. And that's all I can control.
Word.
So it feels manageable in that way because the problems are so insurmountable. And I mean, and just like sometimes my manager, when I'm like, oh, I don't know if I should take a day off. She was like, Zerlina, MSNBC is going to be there tomorrow. Like, take a day off. You know, the problems, the systemic issues that we all talk about, that we all care about, that we all want to change. It's not like, oh, they'll be there tomorrow, we can't do anything. It's not that. It's not cynical.
Yeah.
You have sort of an understanding of the reality of the challenge, but also know that, yes, we can make change. I mean, like, the alternative was absolutely no possible path towards change.
Yeah.
Like, the end of the thing. And this is the broken thing that we were working with, but at least we can work with it. And I always go back to that point because I just feel, sometimes I feel so, like a brat when I'm like, oh, nothing can change, or I get too cynical. I try really hard to snap out of that because, you know, my aunt marched in Selma and like hid from the Klan. Like that is, she's 70. Correct. Like it's not that old. Like,
correct.
So I just think about all the sacrifices that people made so that I can even try to make some change.
Let's move on to our final segment, which we call Sin Pendejadas, or basically no bullshit.
No bullshit. Okay, so while Trump is losing all of his court battles with his baseless claims, aren't you glad we're not going to have to be hearing about this shit anymore?
Yes.
Talking about election
fraud. Yes.
It is becoming clear that the Republican Party is laying the groundwork to strip voting rights from people of color. So Daniel Nikanian of The Appeal tweeted that, quote, the GOP has done this trick for years, introduced bills to restrict access to voting in the name of fighting, quote, the loss of trust caused by, quote, their allegations of fraud, even when they end up granting that there's no basis to these allegations. Pay attention to this sleight of hands now because it's everywhere, he wrote. The Trump administration is also continuing to fight to exclude undocumented immigrants from the census count as we speak, which is, of course, critical in terms of congressional districting and the Electoral College. Monday, as we're recording this, the Supreme Court, yes, Sonia Sotomayor is hearing arguments just on whether or not to exclude. Are they real human beings? Ugh. Can we count them because they're undocumented? Shut the fuck up. All right, Natalie. So no bullshit. Yeah, a crisis was averted, but it was mostly black votes that have been challenged after they were cast. So yep. What changes do you think need to happen to make sure that hundreds of thousands of people aren't disenfranchised in, let's say, 2 years or 4 years from now?
Oh, man, I feel like I'm going to go first and do like the pessimistic take and then Zerlina will back me up.
And I miss optimism. Yes.
Zerlina will help us sleep at night.
Let's go.
Because, you know, the appeal is right in that this has worked before and it's been very successful. And like I lost my mind over Trump not even tweeting about the executions. I'm losing my mind that these people are like, well, nobody trusts the election system now without saying they're the reason that nobody trusts the election system. Well, that their people don't trust the election system. And I mean, there's got to be some kind of way to write into law all of the things that we saw this round of elections that helped so many black people come out and vote. I mean, mail-in voting, I voted by mail and I'm not sure I can ever go back. Like, I absolutely cannot stand in a line
six hours
to wait to vote. I can't look like that anymore.
Never going back. You could Google. It was amazing.
Right. And then you could just, like, check to see, you know, did my ballot make it? And they would tell you if, like, there was something wrong with it. And you could go in and change it. And they really, really just helped. It helped a lot of people come out to vote. And, you know, that's what they don't want. Because when people vote, it's really hard for them to win because nobody likes you. Now, I wonder if right now is the time for state legislatures to start writing in, you know, like, yeah, you can do mail-in balloting as long as it's postmarked by election day. If it comes in a week late, that's cool too. You know, we'll spend a week counting. We'll start counting earlier. I mean, now is the time for state legislatures to fight against this bullshit before, you know, we're right back here in the midterms and they can be like, well, we didn't trust the election system last time. And, you know, just stuff like that. Otherwise, we have a huge, huge problem. Now, literally anytime a black person votes, they're going to be like, doesn't count. You're black.
Yeah. Zerlina, what are you thinking about in terms of the prep for 2 years, 4 years and making sure that we aren't disenfranchised?
Well, I think a lot of the things in HR 1 will be helpful in terms of trying to reinstate some of the things that were lost when they gutted the Voting Rights Act. So I think this is the second election in a row, I believe, that we didn't have Section 5, you know, basically to prohibit in many ways some of the shenanigans these states were pulling. Because the only reason why they're able to do a lot of these like weird arcane rules, signature rules and crap like that is because those protections are gone. So I think that really needs more attention. And sometimes I get frustrated by the fact that, you know, Democrats aren't more forceful with the messages of the things that they are doing, because we were like, what are they even doing? And I'm like, well, they actually have things they could point to, you know, and they have the challenge of sort of dealing with the misinformation coming from the other side at the same time. So I do see it as a challenge, but I feel part of the work is speaking to people in a way they can understand it, you know, just being direct and being clear so that people understand, you know, what things are needed I think passing HR 1, that's step one. And then I do agree with the state ledge piece on the back end or in lieu of HR 1 passing, because I think that's essential. I mean, it's very clear that they understand. I mean, to the point you mentioned my book, The End of White Politics. I mean, the whole point of the book is that the demographics are shifting away from a majority white electorate. And so one of the consequences of that is Republicans understand that intimately.
Right.
That's why they try to strip away the votes of the people that aren't going to vote for them. And so I think it's, you know, Democrats need to understand that that's the demographic reality as well. And they need to protect the votes of those voters who are most likely to be disenfranchised and actually speak to them directly so that they have a reason to turn out. And they need to produce results so that people can say, oh, I turned out and look,
Amen.
There was this thing that happened. I got health care, whatever it is. Climate change, I don't know. I mean, that's the other existential threat that's looming right over it. I mean, it's like we literally are in Game of Thrones.
We need to get back to the wall. It's a long march. We know what's out there. We have to make it. Have to warn them.
I don't even know what the metaphor is for the pandemic versus like climate change being the White Walkers, but I feel like we thought the pandemic might be the White Walkers, but it's not.
No,
it's like,
no. It's just another house. It's another castle somewhere.
Like this,
they're just evil.
This sucks. I guess that wasn't as optimistic as you wanted.
Zerlina just laid it out for us. It's like A, B, C, D, and then it's all good. Zerlina Maxwell, host of Zerlina on Peacock, and Natalie Baptiste, reporter with Mother Jones. First time guests, both of you. I'm sure you're going to be returning.
Loved it.
Thank you so much for joining Julio and me on this episode of In the Thick.
Thank you so much. It was so fun.
So great. Thanks so much, guys.
I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Ricardo Varela.
Dear listener, remember, go to Apple Podcasts to rate and review us, because where else are you going to be able to hear Zerlina and Natalie just like you did?
Yeah.
Remember to do that because it really helps. Also, remember, you can listen to In the Thick on Pandora, Spotify, wherever you choose to get your podcasts on. Check us out on the web at inthethick.org. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at In the Thick Show. Like us on Facebook and tell your friends and family to listen. In the Thick is produced by Nicole Rothwell, Noor Saudi, and Harsha Nahata, with editorial support from Erica Dilday. Our audio engineering team is Stephanie LeBeau, Julia Caruso, Leah Shaw, Alicia Itoop, and Gabriela Baez. Our digital editor is Luis Luna. Thanks to Raul Perez for recording me. The music you heard is courtesy of Nacional Kept and ZZK Records. Woo!
Woo.
See you in our next episode, dear listener. Bye!
Stay thankful.
Gracias!
Ciao! Yeah, I flub representational. I know. It's like, I feel like I'm in a bad spelling bee. Representational. Okay. Can I have a definition, please? Okay, sorry.
The opinions expressed by the guests and contributors in this podcast are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of Futuro Media or its employees.